The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 226.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have really looked forward to speaking with. I am super, super excited to talk to this gentleman because not only is he a proponent of liberty and freedom, but he is also one of the leading car experts out there. So Eric Peters, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Well, thanks for having me on, George. And that's a really, really nice intro. I do my best to practice wrong think at every opportunity.
Yeah, you know, I first heard you on the Tom Woods Show, Eric. And I go through Tom's playlist and specifically look for your recent episodes to make sure I didn't miss one because I enjoy listening to them so much. And it just dawned on me the other day. I said, why on earth haven't I had Eric on my show? So I told my assistant to see if she could get a hold of you, and here we are. So for my viewers who might not know your backstory or what you do, can you get them up to speed on that?
Oh, sure. I guess I call myself the libertarian car guy. I started out as a just regular old car journalist back in the 90s. But just as everything else has become political, the car business has also become suffused with politics. So it's almost impossible to not talk about the political aspect, whether you're dealing with a car review, whether you're dealing with a highway bill, whether you're dealing with gas taxes, whatever it might be. So I began to mish and mash those two things together. And it occurred to me that it was actually a great vehicle, if you will, for broaching topics, philosophical topics, moral topics, that for a lot of people are kind of not that particularly interesting, but a lot of people are interested in cars or driving or motorcycles. And so it was a great way to introduce that topic to a broader audience. And so that's how I kind of got to where I am now.
And the topic being freedom and personal liberty.
Absolutely. Because is there anything that is more, that embodies freedom more than the open road, to be able to just on the spur of the moment, go wherever you want to go on your own schedule without being on government's schedule?
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir right mm-hmm. there, my friend. So for my viewers and listeners right now, maybe you're not a car guy, although I've got a lot of car guys and gals who listen to my show. I know that for sure because I
read makes sense. Comments.
Yeah. But for those of you who might not be fully enthusiastic about the cars like Eric and I, definitely stay tuned because we're going to go over some stuff that's really going to open your eyes to how intrusive government is in not just the car business, but it's going to help you realize how intrusive they are in our lives as a result of understanding this better. So, Eric, I remember that one of the first times I heard you on Tom Woods' show, you were going over all of these regulations that the car companies have to deal with for things like, gas mileage, as an example.
Everything.
Yeah, but everything. But it's so ironic because you're stating that if the government just got out of the way, the cars that we drive today would get far better gas mileage.
Sure. And we'd also have a great deal more choice in the variety of cars that would be available to us.
Yeah. So can you expand on just some of these regulations that most people have no idea the car companies have to abide by that limit our choice, increase prices, and ironically reduce gas mileage?
Well, sure. The first one, of course, is the mandatory minimum mile per gallon requirements, which are known by the bureaucratic acronym CAFE, which stands for Corporate Average Fuel Economy. And what that means is that every car company has to achieve a certain fleet average mileage. And if they don't, they get dunned with gas guzzler taxes, which, of course, they pass on to us, the car buyer. Now, the curious thing about it is the government says that it has to do this because if it didn't do that, the evil car industry would not build high efficiency cars. And I got to thinking about that many years ago and thought to myself, well, if there's demand for it, why wouldn't the car companies build it? Wouldn't they make money selling what people want to buy? And the fact of the matter is that before these gas mileage mandates existed, which takes us back to roughly about 1976, 77, there was a plethora of highly fuel efficient cars. You could go out and buy a little Volkswagen Beetle. You could buy all sorts of cars that emphasize mileage. You had that choice if you wanted that particular attribute. Of course, there were also gigantic Cadillacs and Buicks and everything in between. So people were free to choose. The problem is the government doesn't like that. The government wants one size fits all. So it posits these mile per gallon mandates that effectively force cars to have all of these things that will improve gas mileage, which of course we end up paying for. And here's where it gets really twisted and weird and bizarre. There are conflicting federal requirements, the safety requirements that have made cars significantly heavier than they used to be, which works contrary to the whole object of getting high gas mileage, because the heavier a car is, the bigger an engine it needs to propel it down the road. And so it ends up using more gas. So that's why today, here we are in 2021, and I think the most fuel efficient non-hybrid car on the market right now gets about 41 miles per gallon on the highway. If you went back to 1980, which is 40 years ago, you could find a car without a computer, with a carburetor, with a manual transmission, very basic little car, that not only I got at least that much, but sometimes got more without all of this technological rigmarole. And that's because that car weighed on average 800 to 1,000 pounds less than its latter day modern equivalent. So, you know, government takes away choices from us. It imposes costs on us. And then it tries to convince us that it's doing us a favor. It's kind of like the guy who breaks your leg and then hands you a crutch and says, thank you very much. And by the way, here's a bill for $300 for the crutch.
Yeah, like Jim Grant says, the arsonist and the firefighter.
Right.
You know, what's funny is my very first car that my dad let me drive around was a diesel Volkswagen Rabbit.
Yep.
Remember those? I think it was a 1980 or 81. And you want to talk about a libertarian. My father was never political at all. But to give you a quick glimpse of how he led his life and how he raised me, you know, I was born in 1973. So in the mid 80s there, when I was around driving age. Mm-hmm. And of course, in Oregon, the legal driving age was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And you could get your permit at, I think, 15, something like that. But even before then, even before I had my permit, so like the latter stages of when I was 14 years old, my father used to not only allow me to drive the car to school by myself, mind you, no license, no permit. And, you know, he said, just don't tell your mother.
You know what? Oh, I had the same experience. We're roughly the same age. I'm a couple of years older than you, but our Gen X group, we experienced that. And I think that was the last cohort of Americans that lived that. And I don't think it's coincidental that we're suffering from a real chronic condition of control and coercion today, because people have grown up with it and so are used to it. These millennials, I really feel bad for them, because from the moment of their first awareness, they are just told, sit here, don't do anything, do what you're told, regulated, micromanaged. These kids, they don't get to get their learner's permit when they're 15 and change. Certainly most of them don't get behind the wheel of a car when they're 14, like you and I did. You know, they're strapped like little Hannibal Lecters into their safety seats. And no wonder they're terrified of everything and standing there waiting to be told what to do by authority. Yeah. It's sad. It's really a sad thing.
How do you think that affects society at large? We'll go off topic here for a moment. As far as the raising of an entire generation that not only prioritizes safety over freedom, but to such an extreme to where the government can now get away with what we've seen them do in 2020, where they literally lock people mm-hmm. in their own homes. And people not only don't rebel against it, but in a lot of states, even today, in a lot of states, people are demanding that the government lock them in their house again mm-hmm. and lock more people in their house. I mean, I just think back again to when you and I were growing up, or my father, or, you know, my mother, anyone in my family, and there is no way that the government could have, I don't care what was going on, there's no way the government could have got away with that. The people would have just said, you're not doing it to me. I'll stay in my house if I so choose, but you're not going to tell me what to do. Well, I mean, go ahead.
We grew up with Bugs Bunny instead of the Teletubbies. Remember Bugs Bunny? And
oh, yeah.
Bugs Bunny's leitmotif was that he was suspicious all the time of authority and of government. You know, the what's up, Doc? And, you know, he was always looking to find out what the real motive was. And so I think that was formative for us. And for that reason, we were more independent. You asked about what kind of a society you want. Well, if you want a society of cringing proletarians who have no initiative and who therefore constitute no threat to anybody in authority, you do what's been done for the past 30 or 40 years to condition and acclimate people to that kind of mentality. America used to be a kind of country that you know, the pursuit of happiness entails figuring out what you want to do in life and then going for it, taking risks, accepting challenges, learning and growing. And that's in contrast to the type of society that unfortunately is developing and which is suppressing the society that you and I grew up in.
Yeah, that's right. And it's just that we're just so risk averse, I would say phobic, regarding safety. And it's just so interesting when you think of the psychology. I think it's as we started to have fewer and fewer kids, you know, there was more of a priority on the one kid you did have. So you were just hyper focused on their safety, and that just expanded to that was maybe the catalyst, but that, you know, they took a few steps further. And the next thing you know, you've gone down this slippery slope to where we are now. But okay, let's move back to cars and let's go over. We've discussed kind of how they defeat their own purposes by making cars heavier and then with the gas mileage. But what else do they do that the normal person would never ever think about to where they're creating higher prices for consumers at all times?
Well, we're reaching a point of technological desperation with regard to what is possible from an engineering point of view, with regard to achieving compliance with these increasingly batty mandates. For example, they are talking about pushing the mandatory minimum mileage that all cars, not just a few, but all cars will have to reach by, I think it's 2026, and it's close to 50 miles per gallon. Now, there's just no way you can do that technically without resorting to some pretty extreme things. One of the extreme things is, for example, I have a new Subaru Ascent, which I'm test driving this week. They send me new cars to drive each week. And this is an 8-passenger crossover SUV, 3 rows, big. And under the hood, it has a 2.4-liter 4-cylinder engine. Now, in the past, you would always have had at least a V6 in a vehicle that size because of the size of the vehicle. You need a bigger engine. Right. Well, in order to squeeze a little bit more gas mileage out of it and to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions, they resort to these tiny, tiny little engines, and then they compensate for the lack of displacement and the lack of power by heavily turbocharging them so that when you push on the gas, yeah, you got your power, but you've added this enormous complexity and physical pressure. That's what turbocharging does. It physically pressurizes the engine. So it places that much more strain on all the internal parts, the bearings, connecting rods, everything, which almost inevitably is going to decrease the longevity of the power plant. So rather than something that would probably run relatively trouble-free for 150,000, 170,000 miles, now you got this thing that's probably going to need a new turbo by the time it reaches 100,000 miles and probably will be burning oil and need to be replaced by the time it reaches 170,000 miles. Yeah. And for what? Because it gets 3 miles per gallon better than the V6 would have gotten. And that's not an exaggeration. The difference in mileage is that small on an individual car basis. But when you do the CAFE math and you factor it out across hundreds of thousands of vehicles, which is what the car companies have to do to comply with the regulations, these incremental little differences matter a great deal.
Yeah, that's a great point. But and not only do you have to fix them sooner, but the cost of fixing them when they go wrong is just unbelievably higher. You know, I was with a good buddy of mine who's a car guy. He's actually been a car dealer. He buys and sells them on eBay. He's done that since we were in college, not on eBay, but he's bought and sold cars since we got out of college. And we were in a shop, this was a few years ago, and the guy, the mechanic was working on one of these new King Ranch Fords. And I can't recall if it was the 6.7 Power Stroke, the diesel, or if it's I can't remember which one it was. But he just had the whole entire thing apart. And we're like, my goodness, what are you doing to this thing? And it was something like changing the spark plugs. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was that exactly, but it was something just very, very small. And we're like, my goodness, how many hours do you have to bill to do that job? And he's like, oh, probably 10 or 12 hours. And I'm like, at $80?
Sure. And you know, that diesel engine option too, typically in a truck like that, will cost you about $10,000, all else being equal, above what you paid for the vehicle. And these diesels, which used to sell chiefly on their simplicity relative to a gas engine, their ease of maintenance relative to a gas engine, and their longevity relative to a gas engine, well, that's all out the window. They're not mechanically injected anymore. Mechanical injection is really simple. They're now electronically injected, just like a gas engine. And they have all of these Rube Goldberg-esque things that are affixed to them, particulate traps, DEF, that have made them incredibly expensive, that have made them only fractionally, well, a little bit more than that, but not significantly more fuel efficient than a gas engine, not as long lived, more maintenance intensive. And here comes the kicker. The diesel fuel now is more expensive than gas. And you can remember diesel used to be less expensive than gas. Now it's about 40 cents a gallon higher. So why would you even bother with the diesel engine? Really, the only thing that makes sense, the only rationale for buying it, is if you need to pull a really heavy load behind a big truck. That's pretty much the only rational reason to get a diesel anymore. You know, it's nice to have the blur, 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 and the sound and all of that, but from a functional point of view, there's not much justification for it anymore. And you can thank the government for that.
Yeah, but then if that were the case, I'd just get like a 2001 7.3 power stroke. Remember the 7.3 made by International? Because I don't know if you know this, Eric, but I talk about it occasionally on my channel that back a few years ago, I was helping out my younger brother in Tucson and I got bored. So it just through a random sequence of events, I started flipping trucks. And I got super focused on the 95 to 2002 Fords, the F-250 and 350, because of that power stroke motor. Mm-hmm. I found that if I could find them, but in a no rust state with under 100,000 miles and put them on eBay, you'd like double your money. Absolutely. Almost every single time because they were in such high demand. But they were to your point, they were the opposite. I mean, you had this huge engine bay that you could sleep in the engine bay. You could get to any of the parts. I mean, the injectors are kind of hard to change, but you could get, it was just almost to where the point where you could do it yourself. And that's not talking about the 460 7.5 liters. You know, those got about 3 miles to the gallon. But the good thing is, I mean, anybody could change almost any part on that entire engine in about an hour.
Absolutely. And I think also that's one of the reasons, one of the compounding reasons why so many kids today aren't interested in cars. They're unapproachable. They're so technically complex. They require expensive diagnostic tools. When you're 15, 16 years old, you can't afford that stuff. Right. When you and I were that age, you could go out and buy a basic socket set for $20. And because they were largely mechanical devices, you could get your hands on it and you could look at it and you could kind of figure out, well, okay, if I do this, if I turn that, it has this effect. But with electronically controlled components, it's a lot more sophisticated. You have to have a lot more specialized knowledge. It's very daunting, I think, for a novice, for somebody who's just trying to learn as they go, to figure it out. And of course, the cost is forbidding. If you're 15, 16 years old, you can't come up with $500 for a specialized tool to work on your vehicle. That's ridiculous.
Right. Yeah, that's such a good point. So where do you see the whole car industry going? And then I guess that's a question where I'd like you to also expand on where you see the government regulations and restrictions going in the car industry as well. I mean, are we getting to the point where the government is just going to regulate out internal combustion engines and we just have to go to electric cars? And if so, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, they've effectively done that. That's already in process. But to start off, I'd like to talk about where I see the car industry going. And it's not something that you have to be a prophet to predict because they've actually been rather explicit about it. They are talking about no longer selling cars, but selling, as they put it, transportation as a service, selling mobility. And what they mean by that is it's an implicit admission that cars are becoming prohibitively expensive. The typical new car alone now is 6 years, going on 7 and even 8 years. It's a reflection of the fact that people simply can't afford them anymore unless they stretch the payments out so far as to make them doable. The problem, of course, though, is you can't do that forever because of depreciation with vehicles. After about 5 or 6 years, the value has plummeted to such an extent that in many cases, the vehicle's not worth what you still owe on it. And banks aren't stupid. They know how to do math, and they're not going to make loans on these vehicles because they know a lot of people are just going to say the heck with this and walk away from it. Right. The car industry knows that too. So what's the solution? Rather than do the rational thing and say, wait a minute, we really ought to think about making cars more affordable. What they want to do is get everybody on this payment plan, and you have a subscription to a vehicle. You tap an app on your phone and somehow poof, like Genie from I Dream of Genie, your vehicle shows up and you get a ride, you get taken somewhere. That's I think what they see as the future. And that gets us into this whole electric car thing. The government is making it impossible almost from a regulatory point of view to continue building any car that isn't at least a hybrid, if not a complete electric car, via the so-called zero emissions requirements, and also by just upticking the mandatory mileage minimums to the point where if a manufacturer wants to sell, say, a truck with a gas engine and that truck gets 25 miles per gallon in an environment where the government says all your vehicles you have to sell have to average 50. Well, how are you going to do that? You're going to do that by incorporating a bunch of hybrids or electric cars so that you can combine the two and meet that 50 mile per gallon standard. Problem is, most people don't want the electric cars. They're not very sellable, even though the media wants you to think that this is like some big phenomenon. Most people don't want electric cars. They still constitute only about 1% of the vehicle fleet. Very unlikely it's going to rise unless they force people into it. Well, they're going to offload the cost onto the remaining IC cars. And then I think what they're going to wind up doing, because they're going to have to do this, if they really want to get everybody into an electric car, they're going to make it economically impossible for people to continue to drive other than electric cars by jacking up the prices, by jacking up registration fees, by increasing gas taxes, all of these things. And it's almost a fait accompli right now. You've got the regulations that are already in the books. You've got the Biden administration talking openly about all of these things. And the auto industry, unfortunately, has committed to it tremendously. You may have followed this whole thing over April about Volkswagen calling itself Volkswagen.
Yeah, right.
VW is just one of several car companies that have stated that after a certain date, 2025, 2030, they're not going to even build any more cars that aren't electric cars, notwithstanding there's no market for them because they're so preposterously expensive and they are so functionally gimped relative to non-electric cars. The whole thing is just completely batty.
So how does Volkswagen propose that they're going to do this, and why? If they're that difficult to make, if there's that low demand, mm-hmm. are they just assuming that the engineer, because that's the pushback that you would get from people mm-hmm. who are like Tesla fanatics, and more power to them, but they would say, well, the engineering capacity is going, or capabilities are going to catch up by 2025, which is going to bring mm-hmm. down the price. And since electric cars have fewer components, then you can buy a brand new electric car, let's say for $10,000 in 2025 or 2030, because the engineering will get to that point. What's wrong with that idea?
Well, they've been saying that since I've been covering the car business since the 90s, and it hasn't happened yet. And they're being either dishonest or they simply don't really know what they're talking about when they talk about the simplicity of an electric car. It's true that an electric motor is simple. Yeah. However, electric batteries and the management systems that are necessary to safely charge, recharge, and keep that whole system operating are orders of magnitude more complex than the systems that are necessary to govern the operation of an internal combustion vehicle. And you think about the shock, the road shock, the extremes of temperature, all of the things that a vehicle out on the road has to deal with, and the prospect of one or several things going wrong with this apparatus is pretty high and pretty expensive. And you want to talk about the forbidding aspect of repairability and the cost. There's nothing more expensive than that. Good luck. And there's so many facets to this. These things are also inherently dangerous. Lithium ion batteries, the nature of those batteries is such that they are prone to thermal runaway and fire, which happens sometimes if they're charged excessively, if they're jostled, if the construction materials aren't exactly right, if there's deterioration. It's not like a gas car where you have to have the liquid gas has to somehow be exposed to a spark before there's a fire. With these batteries, if the internal materials come into contact with each other, if there's a short, which could happen, for example, in an accident where the battery case is damaged, it doesn't have to be a spark. The thing creates fire in and of itself and burns. But of course, nobody seems to care about that safety aspect because it's politically correct. That's the kind of thing that we're dealing with right now. It's no longer facts, logic, and reason. It's about politics, emotions, and feeling.
All right. Is that why Volkswagen is kind of making these statements? Are they just pandering to their local politicians to kind of gain political favor?
Or so Volkswagen got curb stomped badly. You know, you might recall the cheating scandal with its teenage diesels. And it's actually quite an interesting story because Volkswagen was the only major car company that was selling an entire lineup of affordable diesel-powered vehicles. You could get a Jetta, you could get a Golf, you could get a Beetle with a TDI diesel that could get 50 plus miles per gallon on the highway for around $23,000. And these things would go 700 miles on the highway before you stopped for what, 3 minutes to fill up the tank and get back on the road again. And because they were diesels, these things would go 300,000 miles easily without any major repair. Well, that was kind of a problem for the electric car agenda, I think. And I think that's why Volkswagen was so viciously curb stomped over cheating on government federal certification tests, not the emissions tests that you take when you take your car in to get registered or get your registration renewed. You go down to the gas station, they stick the little tailpipe sniffer in. There was no problem with that. This was a federal emissions certification test. And the amount of cheating was literally the angels dancing on the head of a pin kind of cheating. A fractional difference in emissions under certain conditions of a particular compound called oxides of nitrogen. No harm was ever actually established. What the harm was that it defied the authority of the government. And I think, in my opinion, it represented a threat to the electric car agenda. Anyway, Volkswagen was treated in an unprecedented manner by the government over this. I think the total of the fines was something like, it was in the many billions of dollars. I can't remember the exact number, but it was enormous. And part of the settlement was that Volkswagen had to put on the hair shirt, had to fund electric car ads, had to fund, you may have heard of something called Electrify America, where they're going to be putting up all of these so-called fast charging stations all over the country. Well, Volkswagen is paying for that. You know, Volkswagen was chastened. Volkswagen was put in the position. Remember 1984? Remember Winston Smith, where he was tortured in room 101 by O'Brien? Right. Yeah. Well, Volkswagen has come to love Big Brother after having dared to question the orthodoxy of the party. So, you know, now it has decided that its future is to do exactly what the government says. So now it's come out with the ID4. That's its first mass market product. And this is a vehicle that costs $40,000 to start and has a best case range of 260 miles before it has to stop to be charged. And that is a best case half hour to 45 minutes if you can find what they like, a hilariously style a fast charger. Yeah. I wrote an article, I titled the article Regression, and contrasted this car with what the TDI Jetta offered as little as 5 years ago. So here you have a vehicle that is roughly twice as expensive, the ID4, as the diesel-powered Jetta, goes less than half as far. And that somehow is something we're supposed to clap about that? This is an advancement somehow? How is this going to benefit the average person? It makes absolutely no sense to me unless you've, you know, drank a couple of bottles of MD-2020 before you start talking about it. Remember MD-2020?
Oh, yeah. Mad Dog 2020. You bet. That and a 40 of Old English.
Yeah.
That's right. That takes me right back to college, man. That's mm-hmm. for sure. I was going to say, they're definitely mixing that MD-2020 with some Kool-Aid.
By the way, to continue on this Volkswagen thing, it's absolutely a tragedy. But as the scandal was breaking and the media got all over this because they just love this sort of thing, Volkswagen had been working on a diesel hybrid commuter car. And this thing would have gotten 260 miles per gallon on the highway. And if it had been mass marketed, its platform was very similar. Remember that Honda Insight from the late 90s, that little two-seater?
Oh, yeah.
Very similar in look and layout to that, except using a diesel hybrid combination. So this is something that Volkswagen probably could have brought to market for around $25,000 or so, because there's nothing particularly elaborate about the technology. Hybrid technology has been around for a long time. Diesel technology has been around for a long time. Can you imagine that? Essentially a free transportation once you bought the thing, 260 miles per gallon. You know, and if they really did care about the well-being of Americans, and if they cared about the well-being of the planet, 260 miles per gallon, virtually nil in terms of the emissions produced by an engine that gets 260 miles on a gallon of fuel, as opposed to these energy hog electric cars which may not produce a lot of carbon dioxide at the tailpipe, but you bet your bippy they produce it at the generating plant, which uses coal, oil, and so on to generate the electricity necessary to power these things.
Yeah, that's a great point that most people don't understand, is they think that if you have a diesel or even of a diesel hybrid, that it's going to blow like black smoke out the tailpipes, like mm-hmm. a 1970s Peterbilt mm-hmm. or something like that. They don't understand that the emissions from those diesels that Volkswagen was making, and I would assume that diesel hybrid would be basically cleaner than air that you would breathe in most urban areas, minus the cars. I mean, it's just so minuscule, the amount of emissions or carbon dioxide output.
Yeah, they make this, the EPA, make this as obscure as possible. If you look into the regulatory categories, they have things called tiers and bins. And this also affects, by the way, heavy equipment like tractors and even outdoor power equipment. And it's something you almost have to be an expert within the industry to even fathom. You know, you're talking about decimal points and zeros. And the nut of it is, the thing that people should take home from this is that the emissions problem, when I say problem, I refer to smog, things that affected human health, that's been solved since the 90s. That's the dirty little secret of emissions regulations. The stuff that's been coming out of the tailpipe of cars since the mid-late 90s is almost exclusively carbon dioxide and water vapor. There's 3 or 4% remaining that's still quote unquote uncontrolled, but it has essentially no meaningful impact at all on air quality or public health. People can go outside, look, do you see smog hovering over the horizon in American cities? You don't, because the problem has been solved, but they don't want to concede that, because that would mean they'd have to stop regulating. So what did they do? They came up with a new boogeyman: climate change, global warming, and now it's all about the carbon dioxide, which they have very, very sneakily equated with emissions. They even use that language. It's emissions now of carbon dioxide, which is an inert, non-reactive gas that has absolutely nothing, zero zip, to do with smog or any public health problem. But they frame it in such a way that when people hear or read a news story about, oh, well, there's a proposal to cut vehicle emissions by 50% emissions, they still think about the stuff that makes them cough and sneeze and makes the air dirty. And all of that stuff hasn't been an issue for more than 25 years as regards vehicle emissions.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Wow, that's a really interesting point. So let's back up a little bit. I know a few minutes ago you were talking about how the end game is to not even own cars, mm-hmm. but to basically have them on demand and have some sort of subscription service. So when you were saying that, the first thing that came to mind was just this Great Reset agenda that mm-hmm. the World Economic Forum always talks about, that yep. by 2030, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. And as normal Americans and or wherever you live for that matter, you kind of scratch your head and you're like, well, okay, so that's their objective, or that's the world in which they envision. So how would we get there? Like, even by their terms, how do you get from A to B? And it sounds like you've kind of thought this through from the standpoint of automobiles. So can you walk us through that in a little bit more detail?
Well, sure, but let's start with something that business that Schwab talks about of you'll own nothing. It's kind of question begging. It's interesting. Okay, if we own nothing, then who owns everything?
Yeah, that was my point. Who owns
the answer is they do. You know, that's what this is all about. It's all about concentrating the world's wealth in the hands of a small technocratic managerial elite who, in the very best case scenario, imagine themselves to be sort of an enlightened lawgivers, because we're just dumb cattle and we're too dumb and dangerous to be allowed the freedom to make decisions for ourselves and manage our own lives. So they're going to take care of us in a sort of a brave new worldian sense, which is, I think, very fatuous. I think it's also very evil. And you know what they're seeking to do, and these are synergies. These are all facets and have a common thread that ultimately results in what we're talking about, them owning and controlling us. And one of the ways that they're going to do that is by ensurfing us through debt. You know, to keep you from owning anything, you just serially pay. And you serially pay with money that they then control. One of the other aspects of this, I think, is that they really want to get rid of cash. They want everything to be digitized. They want to have electronic payments so that they can absolutely control that. So that if you do anything that they define as socially unacceptable, let's say you're a vaccine refusenik, or you don't wear, as I like to put it, the face diaper, well, then, you know, your access to money has been canceled. You can't push your app to get your little transportation Johnny car to take you to your McCube farm factory someplace where you perform your McJob. You know, that's the sort of world that they're attempting to impose on us. I think it's horrible. And I wish more people would really look at it and imagine what it's going to be like to have every aspect of your life monitored, controlled, and to have almost absolutely no freedom left in your personal life, in your work life, or anywhere else. It's a horrific kind of a scenario to me.
So the kind of the steps to get from A to B is that we make these cars continually more expensive, mm-hmm. in the name of a climate change, let's say. And they get more and more expensive to the point where people can't afford them, because you can't make the lease term, or you can't make the loan any longer. You can't do a 20 or 30 year loan on a car. And we haven't even talked about if interest rates go up. That's a whole other dynamic right there. But so people can't afford these monthly payments, and the poor and middle class definitely can't afford a car. So the government comes in and says, fine, why don't we go ahead and buy all the cars, and we'll own them in this fleet, and we'll make sure that they're up to certain standards, safety standards, a mile per gallon, or emission standards. And then we'll have the government auto app, let's say, which is basically similar to Uber. And that's what you use to summon a car whenever you need it. And then we don't have to worry about drivers, because of course they'll all be autonomous. Is that kind of how we get from A to B?
Absolutely. That's generally it. They are systematically trying to make it very difficult, if not impossible, for most people, not all people, but most people, to have a privately owned car. As in the old Soviet Union, as in most societies that have gone down this road, the elite will continue to have cars. Those who can afford to pay all of these fees and jump through all of the necessary hoops, they'll continue to have cars. There were cars in the Soviet Union under Brezhnev and Khrushchev, just not for the average people, just like there were special stores for the Soviet apparat class, the nomenklatura, the politically connected people. They had their own special department stores. They had their own special restaurants that were closed to the average person in those countries. That's the same kind of thing that they're seeking to develop here. A parallel model, you're familiar with the company town concept?
I'm not.
Okay, this was something that was attempted in the early part of the century and going back or back to the 20th and 19th centuries, where, say, a company that owned a coal mine would build housing for the miners and pay the miners in company scrip. And the miners would live in the company-owned homes, and they would shop in the company stores. And they were essentially reduced to feudal serfs in a modern era. And that's what's happening all around us. When they say you own nothing, well, a feudal serf owned nothing. He worked on the land of the manor lord, and maybe he was allowed to keep a couple of potatoes from his crop and got to live in his little hut, but it wasn't even his hut. Ultimately, it was owned by the lord of the manor. That is what these people are attempting to impose upon us.
Yeah. I've been reading The Road to Serfdom a lot lately, just reviewing it over and over and over again, because to me right now, the world is very hard to understand. And whenever I get into that mindset where things just seem crazy and I can't make heads or tails of anything, I try to go back in history and review what the wise individuals that we now stand on their shoulders, so to speak, the experiences they have and what they taught us and what they saw throughout their lives in history, the Milton Friedmans of the world, the Thomas Sowells, the Mises, the Hayek, et cetera.
There's an interesting linguistic and moral inversion that's taken place. You know, capitalism is regularly characterized as a sort of pernicious and cruel system, but in fact, it's exactly the opposite. It's right. Under capitalism where the individual has a degree of freedom that was historically unprecedented, unknown, not beholden to other people. Now, granted, you had to have some gumption. Granted, you had to go out there and figure it out, find something that you were good at, and find something that other people were willing to pay you to do. And if you could do that, you would succeed. And what a great feeling that is when you find out, you know, what makes you happy and what you're good at, do it and make other people happy by doing it. And you engage in the free exchange of goods and services thereby, instead of just sort of sitting there like a lump being told what to do and punished if you don't do as you're told.
And the price is risk. And that's okay. That's okay. Today, we want to try to eliminate risk from every single equation. But you shouldn't have to do that. Sometimes the price of freedom is risk. And that's fine. That's okay. That could be a good thing.
Actually, you know, it's also a thing that needs deconstructing. There's risk as opposed to the certainty of tyranny. Mm. You know, there's a risk that you might fail. There's a risk that something might go wrong. I'd rather take that risk than accept the absolute certainty of being micromanaged, hectored, pestered, controlled, taxed, mulcted, thrown in jail, based on that. And people don't seem to get that. They're presented with this boogeyman of the risk. Oh, you know, if we don't prohibit this, then something might happen. Yeah, well, something's absolutely going to happen if you accept that premise, and something not good.
Yeah. You know, I see that playing out, and maybe this is just because of the safety regulations, but that whole mentality of society that we're just so phobic of risk and that we prioritize safety and our feelings just above anything else, especially freedom. Maybe I'm just overanalyzing it, but like, let me get your thoughts on this. I just had a Mercedes AMG GTS when I was in Phoenix. That was the last car that I have, just kind of a fun car to drive around.
A really fun car.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I've had Lamborghinis. I've had Ferraris. I've had an Audi R8. I've had all those kind of fast cars and European cars. And this Mercedes was probably the fastest. Mm-hmm. I think it only had maybe 520, which, as you know, by today's standards, isn't that much. Yep. But I think the thing's super, super light. And I took it out to the track and ran the quarter mile on it. Yep. And what did I do? I think I only got one run in because the line was so long. And I think I did a 12, but I had a horrible, horrible start. So I was thinking, you know, if I would have got a good start, I probably could have done 11.5 in the quarter. And that's just bone stock. So it was a great car. But my point is, it had so much over engineering that the thing would drive me crazy. Like, as an example, I'd be listening to a podcast like you on the Tom Woods Show on my phone and, you know, through my earbuds or whatever. And I'd get into my car and I'd have to do battle. Literally, I'd have to battle my car for the next 5 minutes because it would try to take over my signal and play it through the speakers. And I'd have to turn the damn thing on. I'd be like, why? Just stop. I just stop doing this. Like, you want to start choking the car. And another thing that it did regarding safety, and I didn't even know that it did this, and it almost caused an accident. Mm-hmm. What was happening is, and I never wear my seatbelt. I always wear it behind me because I just can't.
Great minds. Me too.
Yeah, I can't stand the thing. And hold on, let me write this down because I want to come back to that. So I never wear the seatbelt. So it was behind me. But a good friend of mine was in the passenger seat and they were wearing their seatbelt, right? So I didn't even know it, but it's got this sensor thing. You probably know what it is. But But if you're coming up behind a car and you see the car, it's right there, but you're on the highway or something like that. And if it thinks that you're coming up to that car a little too fast,
yep,
it jams on the brakes. And it, yep, not only does that, but it locks your seat. It pulls, yep, your seatbelt tight. Yep. And then it has this alarm going off. And you're like, what the hell is that? You
see, yep,
just the alarm itself freaks you out. And that almost makes you get in a wreck because you're like, what? It scares the shit out of you.
Oh, yeah.
Like, whoa, whoa, what's going
on? That's called automated emergency braking. And it's just one of the many over-tech things, nanny things that has been put into new cars. One of my least favorites is something called Lane Keep Assist. You know about Lane Keep Assist?
No, but I think my rental, explain to me, because I think my rental car right now has it. That drove me crazy.
Well, the presumption is that you're too much of an imbecile to keep your car in its travel lane. Mm-hmm. So there are cameras built into the front of the car that scan the paint on either side of the road, the yellow line and the white line on the shoulder. And of course, sometimes those paint lines don't exactly correspond to the travel lane. So if your tire touches one of those lanes, or let's say you don't turn on your turn signal when you want to exit the lane or pass another car, the system will think, oh, you're going to run off the road. And there's an electric motor connected to the steering wheel. And the thing will actually try to counter steer and force you contrary to your intended direction of travel. And I think to myself, you know, I could see, say, an elderly woman or just a person who's not particularly sophisticated driving along and not being ready for that. And that wheel starts to jerk and they overreact to that in the other direction and wind up running off the road,
absolutely,
having a wreck because of this, air quotes, safety technology.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing that my rental car that I have now, it's a Kia. I think it's a 2000. I don't know what it is. It's a new Kia something like Optima or something like that. Mm-hmm. And when I was driving, I got it at the Tampa airport and I'm down in Sarasota right now. So when I was driving down on the highway, the thing I would drive for like 10 minutes and all of a sudden it'd start beeping at me and it would flash this coffee mug. Like,
yeah, drowsy driver alert.
Like, stay alert, stay alert, stay, yep, alert. And I kept trying to hit the steering wheel, like all the buttons on the steering wheel to, yep, make it go away. And it just would not go away. And then it's, you know, it'd go away by itself for like 10 minutes. And yeah, then it would come back.
They're inherently distracting. And in my opinion, I think are probably more of a threat in terms of causing accidents than that which they purport to protect you from. It's overload. There's a reason why, you know, I have a number of friends who are pilots, and in an aircraft cabin in the cockpit, you don't get assaulted with bing, bing, bong, bing, bong, 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 and things going on because the aircraft has to focus on the task at hand, and they assume that the guy in the left seat knows what he's doing, you know, and right. This is really the crux of the matter. If you're so incompetent that, you know, you can't maintain proper following distance and you can't brake in appropriate time, if you can't keep your car in traveling, it begs the question, doesn't it? What are you doing behind the wheel of a car? You know, there should be a minimum level of competence presumed in order to be behind the wheel of a car. And this continual dumbing down, it's, again, it gets back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. I think it's attempting to habituate and condition people by making driving so annoying that people want to be in an automated car so that they can just throw up their hands and say, the heck with it. I'm just going to tap at the touchscreen. I'm going to get online. I'm going to check my email. I'm going to watch a YouTube video rather than drive the freaking car.
Yeah. Another thing it does is I was backing out today of a parking spot. And the thing, you know, of course, it's got the little video screen, which I never use. How hard is it just to look behind you? Yep. I still haven't figured that one out. But then, of course, and not only that, it's got like 18 different lines, like some sort of power, yep, grid that you're supposed to figure out. And then, but when I stopped, because there was obviously someone behind me, and there was like a line of traffic to leave. And so the person behind me wasn't moving. But yet I had it in reverse, obviously I had the brake on, but the thing just kept beeping and beeping, yep, and beeping and beeping. And I could not turn the damn thing off. And it goes back to your point. The first thing that goes to my mind is like, you know, we're trying to get these cars to not just drive themselves, but to be our parents, to, mm-hmm, be, they're kind of a reflection or a microcosm of the nanny state and of the government itself. And it's like, and I think that's why it frustrates me so much, because I'm like you, I'm someone who really values liberty and freedom. And I really dislike the government trying to guide and micromanage my life. And I just feel like they're doing that with the automobiles that I drive, that to your beginning point, should be just the personification of freedom.
Sure. And there's an aspect of this too that I think is interesting, in that it's insulting. It's degrading. All of this stuff implies that you're an idiot, that you're kind of a not particularly bright child, a short bus special that has to be led by the hand. And, you know, because if not, you're going to hurt somebody. You know, that's not me. I don't have a problem with some of this stuff if it's opt-in, if it's optional. You know, there are people who maybe for one reason or another, maybe they have arthritis in their neck, let's say, and they have difficulty being able to do as you and I do and just turn around and look and see what's behind them. Okay, great. For them, maybe putting a camera in the car is a good thing. And if they need that to drive safely, hey, I don't have a problem with that. I do have a problem with it being mandated, which it has been. There is a federal law that requires all new cars to have these backup cameras. You know why? Because a couple of idiots backed up over children because they didn't look. And I think it was, I think like 30 or 40 out of a nation of 340 million people ran over a child because they, you know, didn't figure out, hey, is there a kid back there? They didn't look for the kid. Now they have the latest thing that they put into cars is a little alert that comes on for you to check the back seat, even if you haven't got a kid back there, because, you know, your phantom kid might be roasting. And, you know, because some people have left a kid in the back seat, forgotten, if you can imagine that. How do you do that? How do you leave your kid in the car and go somewhere for an hour or two and come back and, you know, your kid's been asphyxiated by the sun? I don't get it, but I do not like being presumed guilty of stupidity absent any evidence that I'm an idiot.
Yeah, that's such a great way to put it. I get in the car now and I just want to start screaming, shut up, like shut up, stop yelling at me. Stop trying to tell me what to do. Just shut up and let me drive.
This is why
you're screaming at your own car.
This is why I love my motorcycles and my old muscle car, which was made years before any of this stuff happened. It is a tonic. It is therapy to just get on a machine or get in a machine that doesn't assault you with all of this stuff and just experience it and go out there and drive or ride and enjoy that. And that's something that has just been taken away from a whole generation of Americans. You know, these poor kids who've grown up since roughly 1995 or so have no clue. You know, you and I got to experience this stuff. We got to savor the last fumes of transportation liberty in this country. They didn't. This is what their world is like, and this is what they take for granted. And I do my very best whenever I have the opportunity to take a kid out in my Trans Am or show them the motorcycle or something, and maybe get their little wheels turning and thinking and do what I can to spread the heresy.
Yeah, I'm gonna ask you a couple more questions here, but before we move on, I just wrote it down and I didn't want to forget. And this is a very selfish question, but I thought of this and I'm like, I've got to ask Eric. Do they make a device that's just the buckle part of the seatbelt that you can just plug in to make the sound stop and not have to buckle your seatbelt? They like sell it on Amazon or something, because I want to buy like 100 of them.
They kind of do, except it's not technically legal. Just go to a salvage yard and find a similar make model to your vehicle and just cut off the part that goes in the male end that goes into the female end. You know, pay the man $5 and there you go. And that solves the problem. But no, it's technically illegal. Just like, you know, do you remember the catalytic converter test pipe that you used to be able to buy in parts stores?
No.
Okay, well, that goes back to like the 80s, and it was hilarious. You'd walk into a Napa or an AutoZone or a place like that, and they'd have the catalytic converter test pipe, which was a pipe shaped exactly like the catalytic converter that fit exactly where the catalytic converter goes, a straight pipe, so that you could test your catalytic converter for the next 20 years.
That's awesome. All right, so my next question is, if someone is a car guy or gal and they love freedom and they love the freedom the automobile represents, what can they do to push back against this agenda where they want us all going around in the McCars working at the McCubicle or whatever?
Well, there's a variety of things they can do. If they have to have a new car, I would recommend that they do support a company that is in line with our kind of thinking. And there is one company that's still in line with our kind of thinking, and that is FCA, which is now Stellantis, the combine of Peugeot that owns Ram, Chrysler, and Dodge. the products that that side of the company is selling, I'm referring to cars like the Charger and the Challenger, the Ram trucks and the Jeeps.
Okay.
Those are unabashedly pro-freedom, pro-fun cars. I had the Ram TRX. Are you familiar with that? About a week or so ago to test drive. That's a Ram 1500 pickup with the supercharged 6.2 V8 from the Hellcat in a truck.
Wow.
It rocks. Wow. Imagine a truck that can run a 12-second quarter mile and haul home a pallet of bricks.
Yeah, that is awesome.
You know, and it's just the balls of it, and the fact that they, you know, they don't, if you watch their advertising and you listen to what they talk about the fun and the style and the enjoyment of vehicles, not, oh, has it got a bigger touchscreen? Has it got the latest driver assistance technology? Their attitude is totally different. So if you're in the market for a new car, definitely support Ram and Jeep and Dodge, because they're making the kinds of vehicles that we want. And make it plain that you don't want some of these things that they're trying to push on you. Like if you go to a car dealer and they're going to try to sell you on all of this advanced assistance technology, tell them, I don't want that. I want, show me something that doesn't have that. Right. Another solution, now this is something that perhaps is more for guys like you and I who are kind of car hip and kind of gearhead people, is to simply buy something older that hasn't got all this stuff. You know, it's, some people are scared of doing that, but I'll tell you what, even if you don't work on cars yourself, vehicles like that, because they're easier for anybody who is competent mechanically to work on, you can always find somebody to work on it for you. And they don't require the expensive, elaborate equipment that these modern vehicles do. You can save a ton of money that way. And you can get out from under a lot of the big brothery stuff. I love my, I've got an 02 Nissan Frontier. That's one of my personal vehicles. I love my truck. You know, it doesn't have a touchscreen. It doesn't assist me in any way. It expects me to get in and drive the thing. The one thing I did to make it more quote unquote modern, I put in a modern stereo system with Bluetooth. So, you know, I don't have to listen to the agitprop coming from the radio station. I can pipe in my music stuff from my iPod. And that's pretty much that, plus the heated massaging seats. I wouldn't mind that. That's pretty much the only thing that I really value from the new cars. And that's also transposable to the old stuff as well.
Yeah. You know, what's funny about that is I still have a couple of those diesel trucks. I kept one in particular, a 2001 7.3 crew cab long bed with only 63,000 original miles on it.
Worth its weight in gold.
Yeah. Oh, it's gone up a lot in value. So I've kept that one in storage, and I've sold some of them recently, but I'm going to go ahead and keep that one. But I was driving that around as a second car when I had that Mercedes AMG GTS. And I just remember how amazing it felt to get into that truck and plug my phone into the charger and know that I wouldn't have to do battle with the car for the next 5 minutes, that if I wanted to listen to my damn podcast over my earbuds, I'd be able to do that. And if I wanted to listen to it over the speaker of the phone, I could do that as well. The car wouldn't choose for me where the signal was going.
And your vehicle isn't going to narc you out either to the government or the insurance mafia and isn't data mining you. You know, a lot of people don't realize this, that these new cars that have all these touchscreens with the apps in them, they're keeping track of what you're up to. And that's kind of creepy to me. You know, they come with EULAs now, you know, end user lease or user agreements, just like when you get a cell phone, which you allegedly own, but in fact, they own the data and they're, you know, they're keeping track of all of that. They're doing that with the cars now too. So you buy the car, but they're using the car to sell you and sell all your information.
Right.
And I've got a big issue with that. And I wish more people who are liberty-minded were aware of it and would also take issue with it. Because I would think if you buy the car, it ought to be yours, period. You know, nobody else should have any ability to in any way do things with it or with your data without your very explicit consent. It shouldn't be part of the deal when you sign on the dotted line.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I didn't realize the extent to which that is happening. I knew they're doing that with Teslas just to work on autonomous driving, but I didn't know that other companies were doing that. So let me go back to a couple more questions that were more maybe personal questions, or not personal questions, but kind of, questions that pertain to what I'm interested in. Let's go that direction.
Okay.
And so I was going to ask you, if I, because I like having a nice old truck like that, but I also like having a fun, fast, exotic car. Like I'm a huge, huge exotic car guy. I mean, I absolutely love the Italian cars. And so if I want an Italian car or an exotic car that's fast, that's fun to drive, but doesn't have, but I don't have to do battle with it, then what year and what type, what brand would you suggest? Is like everything because of regulation after 2010 just a no-go, or is there some exceptions to that, or where's kind of the line in the sand?
We kind of have to go back to about 2005, and this is an interesting general subject also, in that once upon a time, these exotic cars, Ferraris, Porsches, Lamborghinis, cars like that, really were orders of magnitude above anything else. If you got one of those cars, you had something that nothing else could compete with. Well, today you can go out and buy something like a Corvette, which is relatively inexpensive. You know, they start around 60 something thousand bucks, 70,000 bucks. And by the numbers, if you look at what that car is capable of doing, 0 to 60, quarter mile, lapping the Nürburgring, any of those objective metrics, it is absolutely the equal, if not the superior, of cars that cost 2, 3, and 4 times as much. So to a great extent, now what you're buying when you buy an exotic car is an exotic price. So, you know, you can actually go a long way buying something less expensive that has a lot of the less elaborate technology. I'm a big fan of the Mazda Miata. I know that a lot of people think that that's a chick car, but I tell you what, it is a hell of a car. And a lot of people make hay with those things on track days. And the new one is, you look at it and it's not a chick car. Look at the cars like a Toyota 86 or a Subaru BRZ, a little bit pricier than that. Get into something like a Porsche Cayman, something like that. These are phenomenal, phenomenal cars that have capabilities far and away above what most people are capable of in terms of their driving skills. And if you get good behind the wheel of one of those things, you can eat somebody who doesn't know what they're doing behind the wheel of a Ferrari or a Lamborghini.
I remember the Monster Miatas. Remember those? I think they put that 5.0 V8 in them from Ford, didn't they?
Yep. Or just go back a little bit. There's some not well-known classics. You know about the Honda S2000 is one of my favorites. You remember that one? It had the screaming little VTEC 4 with like a 9,500 RPM redline. 6-speed manual, absolutely no assistance technology of any kind whatsoever. That thing was a bomb. And you can find those things abundantly for around 20,000 bucks, 25,000 bucks. Guarantee you'll have a good time in one of those things.
Yeah. So about 2005 was the cutoff.
Yeah, roughly. You know, there's some overlap there. But I think as the performance kind of met in the middle, in order to differentiate themselves from the equivalent performing cars that cost a lot less, they had to start putting in a lot of this electronic stuff that now suffuses all of them. One of the things I really don't like about most of the exotic cars now is they're automatic only.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they use automated manuals or something along those lines because they do deliver quicker lap times, more consistent 0 to 60 and quarter mile runs. But you know what? You've taken away a great deal of the fun by doing that. I'd rather have an older, not necessarily as quick car with a 6-speed manual that I control. That's part of the experience. If you're actually racing for money, of course, a tenth of a second matters, and you'll do anything to get that extra tenth of a second. But if you're out on the street, I think intangibles matter, like rolling the gears yourself, double clutching, you know, all that, just timing it, getting it done right. Maybe not every time, but when you bang it perfectly, you really feel good about doing that because you did it, not the car.
Yeah. You know, a couple of cars that I had in the last few years that were really raw like that, that just were actually kind of over the line to being dangerous. I had a couple of Gen 2 Vipers.
Excellent.
And the one was a 97 and it had like the big Hennessy wing on the back, and that was stock. So that was pretty tame. It wasn't too bad. But the other one was a 2000, it's either 2001 or 2002. And it was one of these that the kids put a big supercharger on it that had like 1,000 horsepower or something like that. And I didn't really know what the specs were. It's just, I went to Florida and I saw it. I'm like, oh, I've got to buy this. This is incredible.
Those cars were great. And Chrysler never offered that with an automatic. It was a rude, challenging car. It was the modern inheritor of the spirit of the original AC Cobra that Carroll Shelby drove. Yeah. Scary car, you know, not for everybody. But that's part of the deal. That's part of what made it great. It, in fact, in my opinion, now this is going to sound a little elitist maybe, but it keeps the posers away. You know, you have to know how to drive to be able to get in one of those things. And people who don't, are they know better and they stay away from it.
Well, if they don't, they're going to get a salvage title.
Sure. Absolutely. You know, not just anybody can get into a 707 and jump in the left seat and run that thing down the runway. You know, you kind of have to know what you're doing.
Yeah. All right. So what about the, you mentioned like the Hellcat, the Demon, are those going to battle with me for my cell phone connection, or are those going back to like the Gen 2 Viper?
No. And I can vouch for this from close and personal experience. They do include a lot of this stuff, but the corporate policy, and this is all, you know, sub rosa, they don't state this explicitly, but it's much more passive. You know, you have the ability to disable or turn off almost all of that stuff, which they do include as part of the standard suite of equipment, but it's not nearly as peremptory as some of the other manufacturers, which make it very, very difficult, if not impossible, to completely turn off these systems if they're embedded in the car. Good example of that, almost all modern Toyotas now, there is a button for the traction control, but it only actually turns off the traction control if you stop the car first, and once the car is going faster than 30 miles an hour, the thing comes back on again. And that is fairly typical of a lot of these systems. And it goes with the peremptoriness of it. You know, they want to have you be controlled by the car rather than you control the car.
Yeah, right. It reminds me of that Mercedes I had. And remember what we were talking about when it thinks that you're coming up too fast and it jams on the brakes and locks the seatbelt and basically it promotes you or almost encourages you to get in a wreck. I went to the dealership and I'm like, this is insane. Like, this is dangerous. I need this thing off. And so they showed me how to turn it off. But what happens, Eric, is every single time that you turn the car on and back on, it reboots to where you'd have to sit there and go through the 3 minutes that it takes to turn it off every single time you start your car. So I'm assuming the Hellcat, the Demon, might have something like that, but you can turn it off forever and it doesn't
turn it
come back on.
You can turn it off
start.
Forever. Once you turn it off, it stays off unless you decide to go back in there and turn it on for whatever reason. And that's fine. That's the way that it ought to be. After all, it's your vehicle. Yeah. You know, it's up to you to turn the headlights on or off. It should be up to you to turn any other of the systems on or off.
Okay. So what cars do you think are going to, like, if I had to say, Eric, here's unlimited amounts of money, well, to a certain degree, but you can buy 5 cars that you just park in your garage right now or just kind of drive every once in a while to enjoy yourself, but you think they're going to gain in value. They're going to appreciate in value, almost like gold. You know, they're going to be a store of value as a hedge against inflation, so to speak. What would those 5 cars be?
Well, I think given the state of things right now in the country, I would not say classic or collector vehicles. I would say practical vehicles, and specifically trucks and SUVs, and certain ones especially. The Toyota Tacoma is a brilliant truck. The 4Runner is also an excellent vehicle. The Lexus GX 460 is a great vehicle. These vehicles do not yet have direct injected engines. They don't have small turbocharged engines. Another good one, I would recommend any Ram pickup truck, a Jeep, basically anything like that. These vehicles, the value of them is astonishing. I did a little bit of looking around with my truck, and I bought my truck used. My truck's an 02 Frontier, and I bought that thing, I guess, about 11 or 12 years ago for like $7,500, cheap little truck. I could turn around and sell that truck right now for $4,000. Yeah. You know, any of these older vehicles, these trucks, because people don't want all of these pestering, nannying, electronic, over-the-top, unapproachable systems that are being put into the new vehicles. So they're buying up these old vehicles. If you go on to any of the used vehicle pricing sites and shop around and see what they're going for, it's crazy. And there's a finite supply of that. This is a whole capital exercise in capitalism 101. And there's only so many of those vehicles still out there. So that diminishing and decreasing supply relative to the increasing demand is causing the prices of these things to go up. So if you have one, keep it. And if you haven't got one, get one while you can.
Yeah, that's, see guys, what I've been telling you about these 7.3 diesels, these trucks, I say that they're a store of value, just like gold. And There you go. The car specialist himself is confirming that. So why would you shy away from classic cars?
Well, because a couple of reasons. Classic cars, the market has largely been driven over the last few years before things went crazy by aging boomers and aging us, Gen X people, who are trying to relive their high school days and their youth by buying the car that they had back when they were sophomore in high school. And that helped to rise the values of these things. But the boomers now are getting to the point of checking into the nursing homes. And you know, people like you and I are more concerned with other things for the most part than going out and spending $50,000 or $60,000 on a restored vintage muscle car. Right. They're not very practical. I mean, they're great to have. I love my Trans Am, but what use is my Trans Am? You know, I love to go out and look at it. I love to go out and drive it, but it's just not a very practical vehicle. And would I buy a vehicle like that right now if I were looking for something to put money in vehicle-wise? And the answer to that is probably not. I would do kind of like what you did, and kind of like what a friend of mine did, actually, and went out and bought an old 90, I think it was a 96 or 97 Ram diesel with the Cummins turbo, mechanically injected turbo diesel.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's just, you can't lose with that. You know, even if things kind of don't go awry, as I suspect they're very likely to, this is something that you can always use. It's very practical, very functional, and you can always turn around and sell it. You're not going to lose money on it. It's a great way to just at least shepherd the money. You know, it's not vulnerable to inflation in the way that Federal Reserve notes are. There's really no downside to doing it. Worst case scenario, things are okay. You don't need it. Well, okay, I'm going to turn around and sell it. And pretty much you'll get what you paid for it back. And then you can buy something else with the money, maybe a classic car at that time.
Yeah, great point. All right, Eric, I really appreciate your time. Man, this was so much fun. I really loved this conversation. For my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Well, they can go to epautos.com. That's my little oasis of sanity amid sickness psychosis. And by the way, you know, I'm going to try and get this camera operational. I wish I could show you. I'm sitting here in my office, and you could see my restored two-stroke Kawasaki triple from back in the 70s that I keep around for visual inspiration.
Yeah, I've had several motorcycles too. You know, the last bike I had was a Ducati 1098S.
Oh, that's awesome. That is awesome. You know, actually, I got invited by Ducati and Aprilia a couple of years ago to do a track day with them down in Birmingham. And not only did we get to drive the street bikes, they brought their race bike and they let us take a couple of laps on the race bike.
Yeah.
And that was one of the high points of the last 15 years of my life. That was awesome.
All right, man. Well, let's just do this. Maybe in a couple months or so, we'll just schedule another update for cars, because I mean, I could talk to you all day long, and I know so many of my viewers and listeners are car guys and gals and obviously lovers of freedom and liberty. So we'll just have to do it again soon, and that will give you some time to get the camera working. But Perfect. It's all about the content. All about the content.
I'm game. That sounds fantastic.
All right, Eric, thanks again. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, George. Appreciate it.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to join me in Miami this June 11th through the 13th for Rebel Capitalist Live, the investment conference. And this is not over Zoom. This is face-to-face. I'm bringing a lot of your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist Show to Miami under one roof to speak, to give you the knowledge you need to increase your personal freedom, to become a better investor and make larger returns over the next few years when we have this financial uncertainty that's being caused by the Fed and the government. And finally, it's going to give you an opportunity to really take your understanding of macroeconomics and the world around us to the next level. We've got some incredible speakers lined up that are going to completely blow you away. People like Mike Maloney, Jason Hartman, Ken McElroy, Lynette Zhang, Mark Moss, Brent Johnson, Jeff Snyder, just to name a few. The tickets for this event are really going to sell out fast, so make sure you go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now to get all the details and to reserve your spot. We need to come together as a group, as a community, especially after what we dealt with in 2020 in 2021 so we can learn how to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. And we need to do this as a group, as a community of fellow rebel capitalists. So don't waste any time. Head over to rebelcapitalistlive.com and I will see you in Miami.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.